Unsere Empfehlung für deinen Podcast? Frisches Obst und knackiges Gemüse von Aldi. Immer günstig und natürlich mit dem Aldi-Tiefpreisversprechen. Zum Beispiel knackiges Gemüse, saftiges Obst, frische Backwaren. Kurz gesagt, mehr Frische für alle. Entdecke jetzt viele weitere Angebote zum Tiefpreis in deiner Aldi-Nord-Filiale. Und weiter geht's. Einfach lauschen und genießen. Aldi. Gutes für alle.
This episode of Watching the Throne is brought to you by you, the listener. We've chosen to keep the show ad-free and only ask for something small in return. Please head to iTunes and let us know what you think of the show. Those reviews really help with our exposure. And if you'd like to make a small monetary contribution, head to patreon.com/kanyepodcast, where you can donate increments of as small as $1 per month. Thank you so much, and stay wavy.
Everybody want to know what I would do if I didn't win. I guess we'll never know.
So keep your love, I don't get enough of it. Jesus just rose again.
Listen to the kids.
Welcome to Watching the Throne, a lyrical analysis of Kanye West. My name is Chris Lambert, and today we're doing a storie with Zach O'Malley Greenberg. Zach, say hi to everybody and introduce yourself.
Hey, Chris. Hey, everyone. Thank you for having me on. My name is Zach O'Malley Greenberg. I am the media and entertainment editor of at Forbes, where I also edit the quote-unquote Forbes list that you may have heard in a number of hip-hop lyrics. And on the side, I write books largely about the business of hip-hop, most recently a book called Three Kings, Diddy, Dr. Dre, Jay-Z, and Hip-Hop's Multi-Billion Dollar Rise.
The subtitles to those books, it's always like a nice 1-2 punch, right? You get that poetic first title and then that like very concrete second title.
That barely fits on the cover. You know, you have it kind of running off the edge, but you have to get all of the ideas in there so that people know what they're getting into. And you feel like you have even more that they need to know, but they really have to read the book to find out. So, yeah, exactly.
You just put the full book on the cover, just really small print.
Yeah.
Well, so you have a pretty unique perspective on Kanye then as a fan of hip hop, fan of his music, but then also in your professional realm at Forbes, but then also with the kind of books that you've written that focus so much on one of Kanye's closest collaborators.
That's right, with Jay-Z. Kanye is certainly a character that, you know, keeps coming up sort of almost with the frequency of a Beyonce in the Jay narrative. So, you know, Kanye is somebody who I've spent a lot of time paying attention to and thinking about. And also, you know, he's sort of one of these characters who I've spent, you know, the bulk of my adult life as a journalist covering the business of entertainment following. So, you know, he's really somebody who kind of came into his own just as I was starting out. And you know, I've certainly been tracking him for Forbes and, you know, just also as a fan of hip hop, you know, in that way throughout.
And with Three Kings, as you said, the focus is on Jay, Diddy, and Dre. But would you put Kanye as kind of like the prince of that next generation?
Yeah, I think, you know, most certainly you could. And one of the things that people ask me about Three Kings, and, you know, it's the three wealthiest rappers on the planet, but also the three wealthiest American musicians of any genre. You know, so it's kind of the story of – it's really three things. It's a story of each of them. It is a history of the business of hip hop, and it's also a blueprint for aspiring entrepreneurs to be able to look at each of one of those three kings and the paths that they took and say, all right, well, here, I'm going to take this page out from this one and this from that one and so forth. And, you know, I think Kanye doesn't fit into that, you know, into the three because he's not among the three wealthiest. And also, you know, you wouldn't necessarily want to follow Kanye's business plan. It's, you know, it's kind of all over the place. I mean, you know, business wise, I think, you know, Kanye probably wealthier than the average person, but, you know, could be up there probably with the Jay-Z and Diddy and Dr. Dre if he were able to harness that creative energy in a little more of a structured way, which, you know, structured is sort of like the last word that we would associate with Kanye West at this point, right?
Yeah.
I would add, you know, I think people because people ask me a lot, you know, who's sort of the fourth or the fourth king, or who would you put in that next tier, and so on. And, you know, there's an argument for Drake. There's an argument for 50 Cent as somebody who had kind of reached that level. You know, you could look at somebody like Wiz Khalifa with the opportunities that afforded him as a connoisseur of marijuana when you know, the cannabis industry is booming. But, you know, one of the names that comes to mind for me is Kanye, because when you think about it, it's like, how do people become insanely wealthy? Usually they have one really great idea and somebody pays $1 billion for it. So, and in fact, people who I interviewed for the book, you know, they would say, like, when I ask who's going to be the first to $1 billion, a lot of them said Jay-Z, a lot of them said Diddy, some said Dre, and, you know, and they're all pretty close, and it'll probably be one of the three. And most likely, I think Dre, when some of his Apple stock vests this summer, depending on where their share price is. But, you know, Kanye is that guy who could just have a $1 billion idea at any point. And, you know, he could make the next Instagram, and, you know, in 6 months he sells it to Facebook, and he's the first to $1 billion. So, you know, I would definitely put him in that sort of like prince of hip hop category, right behind the three kings.
Does it have you very fascinated whatever this Yeezy sound might be?
What's that?
Oh, there's something that a few months ago there was a paperwork that was filed for like a Yeezy sound, and people have just been speculating, is this like some kind of streaming platform that Kanye is going to have? Is it something like specifically for his music moving forward, or what's it going to be? But it seems like it's kind of potentially could be this outside of the box Kanye idea.
Oh man, well, I will be watching very closely to see what he does, but he's certainly a mysterious character.
When you're talking about like the potential wealth that he could have had in structure, like Drake comes up. Drake is somebody that very much blew up, and instead of going into the arts realm that Kanye has, he stayed very much in the mainstream, I'm making music for money kind of way that has his view, like his artistic leanings and everything, but is still very much intended for consumption.
For sure. And he's prolific as all hell. You know, he's constantly putting out albums and singles and, you know, LPs and EPs, whatever, you know, and playlists, whatever you want to call it. And, you know, he's the most consumed artist on the planet. And there's no reason that Kanye couldn't be, except that he's such a freaking perfectionist, and he chooses to deprive us of that additional you know, creative output until he gets it just right. And then even then, of course, he's still tinkering with it. So, you know, I actually, before this book, the Three Kings book, I wrote a book called Michael Jackson, Inc. And before that, I wrote a biography of just Jay-Z. But the Michael Jackson book, you know, it really brought you sort of into the psyche of this guy, this creative genius, who actually had a lot of brilliant business ideas as well, that he just didn't always sort of execute, let's say, on the level of a Jay-Z or a Diddy or a Dre, because a lot of times the creative impulses got in the way, which is, you know, not to demean his creativity, but more to say, a long way of saying that I see Kanye more like Michael Jackson than like a Jay-Z or a Diddy or a Dr. Dre. And, you know, that relentless pursuit of artistic perfection, you know, cost be damned, timeline be damned. That's something that Kanye does. And, you know, when you look at, I mean, the number of acts in the world who are capable of touring arenas, you know, I don't know, probably, I mean, there are probably a couple hundred American acts who can do it. you know, the number of acts who could sell out a stadium. I mean, Kanye hasn't done it, but I think he could. I mean, just in terms of name recognition, you know, there are very few people in the world who are more famous than Kanye West. And, you know, sometimes that's a positive association, sometimes it's a negative association, but just that name recognition that he has, you know, I think there's a path he could have taken that would have led him to be playing, not just arenas, but stadiums and so forth. But, you know, I don't know that he would ever want to play a stadium because he's, you know, got to have so much control over the elements of the show. And every show has to be this extravaganza that will, you know, leave the viewer absolutely stunned, whether it's, you know, from on the Yeezus tour snowing in the arena to on the last one, you know, the tilted stage, as his pal Taylor Swift likes to call it, you know, flying carpet or whatever, whatever you want to call it. He has to have some kind of outrageous, amazing, mind-blowing thing attached to it, which is great for the audience, but is not so great for his bottom line, and you know, and results in him having these tours that are, you know, not as profitable as they could be, versus somebody like Jay-Z who goes out and, you know, it's not like it's Jay-Z unplugged, like sitting there with a guitar and that's it. you know, sort of like the Eagles a couple of years ago, they did the history of the or just with their guitarist telling stories. That's it. You know, there's a little more production with Jay, but, you know, but he plays arenas in the round, you know, so as to make sure that he gets as many opportunities to have seating. You know, he doesn't have a crazy, ridiculously expensive, you know, setup, and, you know, he's able to take home. I mean, when we do our calculations for Forbes on what an artist takes home of, you know, percentage of gross, the standard is about a third for the average pop act. And, you know, some hip hop acts can take home more than that, especially if they don't have a live band involved, if they have stripped down production, if they're, you know, playing from track, that kind of thing. And, you know, but Kanye West, on the other hand, I mean, he tours like the most expensive of all pop acts. I mean, he's, you know, he's sort of on a Lady Gaga type of level. You know, again, that's great for the audience, but not so great for his bottom line. So I think if he were to, you know, reorient his priorities a little bit, you know, he could be worth hundreds of millions of dollars more. But that's, you know, that's not where his heart is. And that's fine because, you know, that's what makes him Kanye.
Yeah, we all benefit from that.
Yeah.
I was watching a footage from the Yeezus tour today where he went on like a 20 minutes rant. And at one point he was talking about how he doesn't, what's everybody else gained from him having a Maybach? Like nothing. Like right. He wants to give people shoes. He wants to give people clothes. He wants to like give people music and like give, he doesn't get anything from having like the car. Like they don't get anything from having the car.
He wants to tear the roof off of the Maybach and, you know, put it on the trunk or whatever, you know, in order to make art, for sure. Yeah. I think that's what Kanye is all about. And, I mean, I was reading something he said about how, you know, when Steve Jobs died, he felt like he needed to sort of fill in some of the blanks and sort of the creativity in the consumer universe and bringing beauty into the world, you know, and not just sonically. I think that's where his priorities are these days.
Agreed. It's almost like it's impressive that he's as wealthy as he is, despite his views on art and how he goes about his career.
Oh, for sure. And, and again, you know, I mean, he really could be a lot more wealthy if he kind of did things a little differently.
Well, so getting back, you know, you have in the three books, currently the first and the third being about Jay-Z, with Empire State of Mind, that was being written way back in 2010, 2011.
Yeah, that's right.
That's comparing the relationship that Kanye and Jay had then, especially with Blueprint 3 having just come out, which was so produced by Kanye, watching the Throne about to drop or having just dropped, to go from where they were then to where they are now, kind of this cold war between them. Was that surprising to you?
I don't think anything is ever surprising with Kanye, unless it's not surprising. Do you know what I mean? Like, I would be, I'd be really surprised if he came out tomorrow with, I don't know, an album packed with old soul samples, you know. I think that's the only thing. The only thing predictable about Kanye is that he's unpredictable. So in that regard, no. But, you know, it really was a different world when you think about it. And when I was first writing Empire State of Mind, it was right as Blueprint 3 was coming out. And I remember hearing Empire State of Mind before it came out and thinking, like, this is when you know when you hear a song and you're like, this is a hit, I just want to listen to this over and over again, this is going to be so freaking huge. That was a moment that Kanye West was very much a part of, not on that track, but on the album more broadly. And, you know, to go from there and then into Watch the Throne, which I dealt with a lot in the paperback edition. I wrote a whole new chapter called New Watch Alert. And it was basically about how Jay-Z and Kanye had founded this sort of subgenre of rap, you know, luxury rap, and talking about how important that was for Jay-Z and how, you know, this is something that Jay-Z had tried to pull off, about 5 years beforehand, or was it 5 or 6 years before, and something like that, with Kingdom Come. And, you know, he comes with this big comeback album after he'd retired from rap. And, his whole thing was talking about hanging out with Gwyneth Paltrow and Chris Martin and the Hamptons and, you know, all of his fancy things, but not just in the way that he used to, about sort of, you know, bragging about wealth and cars and things. It's, you know, suddenly he was rapping about Mercedes. You know, he was having the Pagani Zonda Roadster in his music video. It's like, what is a Pagani Zonda Roadster? And his whole attitude was like, I'm so wealthy that you don't even know the things that I'm rapping about. And, you know, that was kind of like mind blowing on a whole new level, but people weren't ready for it. And they were like, who's this guy? What the hell? And somehow the way that, perhaps it was just 5 more years of you know, the world being familiarized with the new Jay-Z, you know, maybe it was marrying Beyonce. But, you know, maybe it was also Kanye's participation in this and the way that Kanye articulated it, you know, luxury rap, the Hermes of verses, you know, like it really brought something in a way that made it clear what he was trying to do than Jay had ever done. And, you know, talking about Maybach bumper stickers, read what would Hova do, you know, that like really kind of encapsulates what Jay was trying to accomplish. I actually, for Empire State of Mind, I went online to one of these websites where you can get custom bumper stickers, and I made up what would Hova do bumper stickers, and I put the website for the book, you know, which like linked to the Amazon page on the bottom.
That's awesome.
Them out. I think the whole thing, the feel of that album, even when you got the CD, you know, that Givenchy design, you know, kind of gold encrusted cover, you know, which clearly was just all Kanye, right? I mean, that just reeks of Kanye. it really brought it to another level. And, you know, I remember that tour at the time, you know, when it happened, I think it was the highest grossing hip hop tour ever, having the two of them together, you know, on that one. And, you know, it was funny because I think that tour was kind of like the perfect marriage of, you know, business wise, of Jay-Z and Kanye in terms of the mix of aesthetics and efficiency. And it was the two of them, you know, sort of starting out on the stage, you know, very sparse, minimalist setup, and then sort of like popping up on these giant blocks in the middle of the floor and then sort of rapping at each other across the standing room only. So on the one hand, it appealed to like some aspect of whatever Kanye was into at the time, the sort of minimalistic fashion, you know, artistic sense. And it appealed to Jay, who I'm sure was like, well, gee, why don't we, like, how can we make this as cheap as possible and look cool at the same time and, you know, appease Kanye and like make both of us a ton of money, which it you know, it obviously did. You know, since then, of course, his tours have been a lot more extravagant and, you know, I'd have to go back and look at the numbers, but I would wager that, you know, he took home more on Watch the Throne than he did on either of the subsequent solo tours, you know, even after splitting the proceeds with Jay.
That's really funny to think, like, in the wake of Jay making him be so, like, sparse on the staging, Kanye had to go with Yeezus and make, like, the Yeezus staging.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I don't know for sure that that's the case. I'm just guessing, you know, having studied both of them, that's how it went down. But you can kind of imagine them, you know, in like a conference room at the Mercer Hotel, Kanye's like, well, I want the gold, like, Chihuly thing. And Jay's like, no, we're going to cut it out. No, don't have, going to do this on the efficient, you know, it's going to be sleek, blah, blah, blah. And then kind of coming to this compromise that ultimately really worked out.
Yeah. Do you think Jay comes out with 444 if he hadn't worked with Kanye so closely for so many years?
Man, I don't know that there's anything that Jay does now that you can't say is somehow influenced by Kanye, you know. I think his career just went in an entirely different direction and you know, after Jay-Z's debut Reasonable Doubt, you saw him kind of like wandering between, you know, that kind of rugged or, you know, early 90s kind of gangster infused sound, and then, you know, teaming up with producers like Puff and whoever to get sort of like a glossier production, you know, in sort of the more cheesy late 90s style, and kind of, you know, not being totally comfortable doing that, but feeling like he had to, and then kind of tacking back to the grittier beats that, you know, that were more satisfying, but perhaps didn't quite pull in the larger pop crowd. But then, you know, with Blueprint One, you know, finding this perfect mix of sort of like aggressive yet celebratory beats that, you know, appealed to a pop crowd while not sounding like cheesy, you know. and I think that's what Kanye brought to the table with Jay. And I think that, you know, that kind of side of the production in Jay's music will, you know, is something that, yeah, you can't really extract Kanye from at this point, like, whatever he does.
Encoded in Jay's DNA now.
Yeah, I mean, and vice versa, you know. But yes. That, you know, almost, I would say probably, I mean, you know, lyrically, I'm sure, you know, a lot of the wittiness and you know, some of the mannerisms that Kanye is thinking about and using, you know, a lot of that goes to Jay, although sonically, of course, he's going in all kinds of different directions that probably Jay-Z wouldn't necessarily consider.
Yeah, it's funny thinking about like early Kanye career. Like, does he push himself as hard as he does to improve as a rapper and reach a level of? I mean, he always had the drive to reach that level of superstardom, but having Jay as kind of the hurdle to get over on his albums, does he really take himself to that next place that he may have not have reached?
Yeah. You know, I think, when you listen to his earlier stuff, I mean, he was always witty, but, you know, getting into some of the lines that happen, I mean, you know, too many Urkels on your team, that's why your Winslow, like that, you know, that's a whole new level, from the early days, you know, as much as those songs were really good. I mean, it just, the wittiness on, you know, sort of peak Kanye, you're like, wow, where did that, you know, where did that come from? Not like it's shocking that he would be that witty, but it's up another level from the early stuff, I think.
Absolutely agreed. Absolutely agreed. Speaking of the early stuff, when do you first remember hearing Kanye?
I just remember through The Wire, and I had a girlfriend at the time who had like a jaw injury, and she just really identified with this because she'd had to have her, you know, some kind of surgery, and it had her jaw shut briefly, and like, you know, she was just, this is before we were dating, but she was like, yeah, you know, I just, and they're both from Chicago, and so there's a lot of conversation about, you know, Through the Wire and so catchy, and I don't know, I just really gravitated toward that song, and then that kind of brought me more into some of his other stuff that he was also very good on.
And you were a hip hop fan at the time?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I grew up on, you know, early mid 90s New York hip hop and such. So it was a pretty easy jump.
And do you remember the first, did you get College Dropout right when it came out, or did it take you a few albums to finally pick up a Kanye album?
I would say I was more of a casual Kanye fan, and I would, you know, pick stuff up whenever, or just listen on the radio or what have you, until, I'd say Graduation was when it was the first one that I was like, I have to get this, you know, the day it comes out, and, you know, fully experience it. Which I think is sort of like a great time to get, I mean, obviously it would have been best to be, you know, on that level from the very beginning, but, you know, I think that trying to understand Kanye as an artist throughout his entire career, you know, waiting, I think Graduation is sort of the last point that you can get into it and like fully understand the arc, you know, because Graduation to me was the culmination of part one, you know, I mean, it's called Graduation. and it's sort of like, you know, the last one before things start getting, you know, kind of crazy, and in a good way, largely. But I just remember, I don't know, I was spending, I had a couple of trips to Chicago that year, and I remember going to see him at Lollapalooza, and there was just such an energy around it. It was 2008. It was part of the Glow in the Dark tour, I think. And there was this rumor, it was in the midst of the presidential run, and it was Chicago, and there was this rumor that Obama was gonna show up on stage with Kanye because, you know, because of all these things coming together. And it didn't actually happen, but, you know, it things felt so right at that moment, like they could, because, you know, Kanye's star was just like so on the rise, and, you know, and there was just this kind of very magical brew of things happening all around. You know, and of course he put on a tremendous show, and I remember going back to Chicago later that year to see my relatives at Thanksgiving, and just, you know, listening to that album as I landed at O'Hare, and just, I don't know, feeling very into the Chicago vibe of it all. So yeah, I would say that was my, you know, first immersive Kanye album experience, and certainly everyone since then, you know, I get it the day it comes out, or, you know, start listening the day it comes out, or what have you. Sign up for Tidal so I can hear it the day it comes out.
Do you remember what songs were jumping out to you when you had Graduation on in that first? Because I know over time different songs like come to the forefront of like, oh, now this is my favorite, or we go back and forth. But back then, what was grabbing you?
I think the one with Chris Martin, for some reason, just really stuck with me. And, you know, maybe because of the whole, the Jay-Z, Kanye, you know, Jay had, you know, next thing I know, Jay had a song with Coldplay, line of reasoning. But, you know, I think that also kind of really cemented his status as a superstar, not just of, you know, not just of hip hop, but of any genre, to the point where he'd be going toe to toe with Chris Martin on a track like that, on a track that I really liked, that, you know, just kind of was very evocative of a time and place for me in my life as well.
Yeah, there's something about Homecoming, especially coming at the end of that album, that's just very, I don't know if addictive is the right word, but it really creates that earworm where you're just like, I need to listen to this.
Yeah.
Over and
yeah.
over.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, and of course, Stronger. I mean, you know, I think that was also, you know, something that really contributed to this mainstreamification of Kanye. Talk about addictive. You know, that was a song that you just, I remember, again, I get that album was just related for me to a lot of times and places in my life. And I was just graduating college, so things were sort of like very memorable, you know, in being a real adult for the first time, you know, that kind of thing. And I remember I was doing the story for Forbes, and it was about a company in New Jersey that made the machines that feed powder into pills and cornflakes into cornflake boxes. And I rented this like shitty Dodge crossover SUV to drive to like deep New Jersey and like go through this industrial, weird little industrial company and write about it. And the whole time I'm pretty sure I just listened to Stronger on repeat to get amped up for it. So
that's awesome. Yeah. To me, Stronger is always evocative. I was my junior year of college, and it's just every Friday, Saturday night in the basement with the red cups, drinking, and Stronger being like one of the kickoff songs of the party.
Yeah.
It's like, I knew it was,
well, that's a good one to have.
Yeah. I knew it was 10 o'clock on a weekend if Stronger was playing. Also, you started getting into like your career as a journalist at that point, and you've been a fan of Kanye. You're coming into just a fan straight up of his albums and music. Did starting to work in the professional realm of journalism change or expand how you viewed Kanye, or give a different kind of facet to how you viewed Kanye?
So that was the year that I started the Hip Hop Cash Kings package, the list of the top earning rappers in the world. And I don't think he was on it that year. Maybe he was. I don't know. I think, as I recall, it took him a year or two to get on it. Maybe I'm wrong. I'd have to go back and look. But, you know, that was when I started, you know, reevaluating a lot of the way that I looked at hip hop. Not to say that I didn't, you know, that I stopped liking rappers that I used to like or started liking new ones. But, you know, it just gave this, it's sort of like you put on AR goggles or something, you know, and you start seeing, you know, like all these Pokemon or something on the street that just weren't there before, and augmented reality, right? It's like, I'm kind of mixing Pokemon Go and augmented reality, but you know what I mean? Pick one or the other or both. And that's what it was to me. There was just this whole other layer of the hip hop world on top of it. And, you know, a lot of the guys who you thought were making a lot of money were making a lot of money. Like Jay-Z was making a ton of money, but then, you know, there would be people like Tech Nine, you know, who were making like more than Kanye some years. Whoa. Because, you know, Tech Nine just has this like incredible setup in Kansas City, and he owns all his own trucks and his own warehouse with merch and all this stuff and his own studios. And so everything is done in-house. It's all independent. You know, he keeps so much more. He sells, you know, probably a third as many albums as some of the artists like on that level, but he keeps three times as much of the money, maybe more. You know, so seeing stuff like that, you know, kind of makes you, it just gives you more, you know, that extra layer over the whole business. And you know, maybe you're a little more fascinated by somebody like that. It's like, well, how did they make all that money? Or like, why are all these people listening to, you know, I don't know, some random, rapper, you know, in like Arkansas that you've never heard of before, and kind of ask yourself what it is about their music that kind of translates to this commerce.
It's makes me just think about the first time I heard Tech N9ne and trying to think like what my response was to him.
Mine was like, what is he saying? What? He's too fast.
Right? Like, very, you know, impressed but confused.
Yeah. I mean, usually these days, you know, what is he saying? It's the whole mumble rap scenario. But, you know, but now he's talking too fast instead of, you know, not like not mumbling. He's cramming too many syllables into that. I mean, too many. He's doing a great job. I need to catch up, kind of thing.
So we get to, as you said, when Graduation came out, Kanye has proven himself to be this massive star. He's has this energy at his concerts and shows, and it seems like only greatness awaits. And then we get 808s, his most debated album, and then the Taylor Swift VMAs event. What were you thinking at this point for him?
Yeah, well, you know, I think there were two events in Kanye's life that irrevocably changed his career. One of them was his mom dying, and one of them was the Taylor Swift thing. And you know, his mom dying, you know, clearly he was very close with his mom. He was devastated, and that fed a lot into his narrative and to his work. But, you know, I think in a way, I think the Taylor Swift thing in some ways altered the trajectory of his career even more. And I just remember, you know, thinking obviously it was stupid of him to go up there, but the backlash was so insane, and it was just this like crazy racially charged like bullshit like American id thing coming through, and a lot of the people participating in it didn't really acknowledge that. And you know, and to this day, like, you can talk to people who get it in the hip hop world and they totally understand it, and you can have conversations with them about it. But you talk to like a lot of mainstream Americans and they're like, that guy, you know, is a monster. It's just really hard to unpack a lot of that for some people. And, you know, Kanye went from this place of like, you know, I think Graduation and he was really loved. And, you know, even after his mom died, I think that was another layer of people kind of being there for him and a lot of suddenly, you know, this thing happens and it's like he gets knocked off his pedestal. You know, I mean, there's just this rage coming in from all over the place, from like random, you know, famous people who are shitting on him. You know, it just it's just, you know, and I remember he was supposed to tour with Lady Gaga and go on this crazy huge arena tour. And this was right when she was, you know, had just become the biggest, arguably biggest solo pop act in the world. And they were going to go on this joint tour together. And, you know, as sort of like the two biggest acts out there. And he had to bail and he moved out of the country for a while. I mean, it's, you know, again, part of his narrative, because the backlash was so intense. So, you know, obviously he has dissected that moment a lot in his song since. And I wrote a story on the fifth anniversary of it that I called something like The Strange Symbiosis of Taylor Swift and Kanye West, talking about how, you know, that moment, I think, was, you know, in some ways traumatic for both of them, but also something that rocketed them even higher into the stratosphere in terms of name recognition. You know, Kanye, you know, more negatively, Taylor, you know, came off, I think, as sort of like, you know, a lot of people were, oh, like, poor Taylor. We're going to be very sympathetic toward her. You know, this bad thing happened to her. So, you know, she got a boost from it, I think, ultimately. You know, you had sort of Beyonce coming in and trying to smooth things over. So anything that Beyonce touches kind of like turns to gold, you know, so there's that association going on. And, you know, and Kanye, you know, like they say, any publicity is good publicity. I don't really agree with that, but I mean, he sure got a lot of publicity over it. So, you know, it definitely like catapulted him to this even higher place. But, man, what a crazy feeling that must have been to have been Kanye. And, you know, somebody was telling me the other day that he did something like that at a European award show and like interrupted some European act, and like people were clapping and thinking it was awesome. Was it you? Were you telling me that?
Yeah, I think it was me. Okay. during South By. It was it was the European Video Music Awards, and Justice won for best video, which it was a creative video, but it wasn't, it looked like somebody spent like $500 and they just did a lot of like goofy stop motion stuff. And Kanye just went up there and was like, I haven't watched your video. I'm sure it's a great video, but like, yo, Touch the Sky was incredible. I spent $1 million, like, and people are just like applauding and eating it up. And there was no backlash whatsoever. Nothing.
Yeah, it just, I mean, again, I think it gets at this like very dark part of the American id that still hasn't gotten its, you know, its shit together when it comes to sort of like racially charged, you know, like stereotypes and sort of issues of a black man, you know, being in that interacting with a white woman. It caused America to like lose its collective shit, which I think is insane.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's the extra layers of her being like a young white girl in the country genre at that time, and like very much country and having a country family. It's ooh.
For sure.
So following that article in the 5-year anniversary, so that would have been ahead of them making amends leading up to All Day's performance and Taylor being there for that.
Yes.
That kind of renewed friendship in 2015.
Yes. Which I think was, you know, a little surprising at first. And then it was like, okay, well, look, they've grown up. They've all grown up. Everybody's fine about it now. And, you know, I mean, you know, to Taylor's credit, I think she was fairly gracious about it. You know, and to Kanye's credit, he was willing to put the past behind him. I mean, despite this trauma that it, you know, caused him, and you know, of course, it didn't last. this great piece of the two titans, it did not last. And you know, it's like they kind of can't help it with each other, you know, and then you have sort of the latest kerfuffle, you know. But again, it's like, you know, he couldn't resist sort of the creative I mean, I think, you know, creatively, talk about, you know, being provocative. I mean, we don't have really provocative artists, I think, in the way that we used to, you know, like decades ago, and you know, from the 60s, you know, up through NWA and so on. You know, I think in some ways Kanye is sort of like the last rock star in that way, you know, somebody who really will push boundaries for boundaries' sake and just does not give a shit about, you know, the consequences. And I mean that in the best possible way. And yeah, so he decided to make this video with, like, you know, fake naked Taylor Swift and, you know, all these other people, some fake and some real, you know, Donald Trump and all these characters. Yeah, you know, if I were Taylor Swift, I wouldn't be too thrilled about that either. But also, it's like Kanye couldn't resist, right? The continuing that that narrative and, you know, and creating provocative art, which also I understand that side of it too. And, you know, and just like she couldn't resist, you know, making that comment about his, you know, the, in that song, which she may or may not have written about him, you know, with his tilted stage.
Could it be about him? Know,
oh yeah, no, everybody has a tilted stage. So, you know, it's just, it's like the story keeps going. And I think in some ways, you know, it's almost like they're sort of Kylo Ren and Rey in Star Wars. And it's, they have this weird connection and they sort of hate each other and they sort of love each other. And it's like, are, you know, are they like friends or enemies or lovers or what? Like, I mean, they're not lovers, I guess.
But that
Kanye
energy.
And Taylor Swift, but yeah, but there's just this very this crazy energy around the whole thing, and like you don't know where it's going, and you know, and what's going to happen. So you know, I don't think it will go in the lyrical direction that Kanye suggested, but infamous, but you know, it just it keeps going.
It's funny to me because talking about that energy that they have and that tension that they have, I feel like addressing it as like, I feel like me and Taylor might still have sex is a really funny tongue-in-cheek way of addressing that tension. And kind of when you see two people that are in the same sphere and they keep butting heads and arguing, usually the joking response is like, when are you two gonna like have sex already?
And right.
Like Kanye playing with that, but then the backlash from it, and as you said, the video. It's always
go ahead.
Oh, it's just always crazy seeing the discussion about it, because the video isn't without artistic merits, but then the video isn't also without like social criticisms about permission and
for sure.
Yeah.
Objectification and you know, image and all of that. And if I were Taylor Swift, yeah, I would have been really pissed off, you know. But you know, then again, if I were Kanye, I don't know. I mean, Kanye's Kanye. You know, he's gonna provoke, and he's you know, he's gonna push buttons, and so he kind of gets himself into these situations sometimes.
Yes, he does. So with the last handful of albums. We have My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy, Wash a Throne, Yeezus, The Life of Pablo. Has that journey been something that you've been there for, or are you more inclined to that old school Kanye sound?
Oh no, I've been there, every step of the way musically. I mean, you know, I think Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy is, not just one of the greatest hip hop albums of all time, but one of the best albums of all time, period, full stop. And I think it's a travesty that it didn't win Album of the Year, that year at the Grammys. And, you know, I think that's his magnum opus, and it sort of combined, the listenability of old Kanye with the sort of boundary pushing of new Kanye. And, you know, And the wordplay just got to another level, and the production was insane, and the guest appearances. I mean, there, you know, it takes a truly like once in a generation album and a once in a generation artist to have that level of supporting cast and not have it overwhelm the album. Like, that was a Kanye album. That was not just some kind of group party. Like, you feel the Kanye all the way through it. No matter if it's Jay-Z or Fergie or Nicki Minaj on the track, it is a Kanye album, and it's telling a story, and it's triumphant, and it's despondent. And I just think, you know, I don't know. I cannot say enough about that album. And you know, subsequent to that, I liked Yeezus. I mean, I liked Yeezus more every time I listened to it, but you know, it's not, let's say, like so much fun to listen to the first couple times, you know. it really, it's like whiskey or scotch, you know, it's really an acquired taste. And, you know, Pablo, I think, to me, I mean, I really liked it. But the whole thing of putting out the album and then changing it constantly, even after it was out, it actually drove me nuts. You know, it's like, can you please just tell me what I, you know, is this, are we done now? Are we, you know, because I think there's a point where when you keep putting brushstrokes on a painting, you know, it goes past being its best self, you know, and it goes into something else. And while I think it's I don't know that there's a moment where I said, where I would have thought it would have been better if you'd left it there. I wanted to know when I could, you know, be sure of what I was listening to. But again, that's Kanye. I mean, he's not going to give you, he's not always going to give you exactly what you want, but he, you know, that's kind of goes to the Steve Jobs side of Kanye, which is he's not going to necessarily give you what you want, but he's going to give you what you don't know you want. sometimes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The thing that always bothered me about the album, release with The Life of Pablo and the changes is that the one that you got for purchase wasn't the most recent one and they never updated it. So anybody that just bought the album doesn't have St. Pablo on it or doesn't have like some of the last changes. And it's just like, can you at least give me that?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And, you know, but at the same time, you know, to go back to the Kanye J narrative, you have him making it available on Tidal and, you know, driving just amazing amounts of subscribers to the service, which, you know, obviously enriched Jay, but enriched Kanye as well as an equity holder. So, you know, there you have Kanye kind of, you know, being involved in a very good business decision that's sort of like also connected with, you know, his artistic decision. So, you know, Kanye and Jay sort of once again converging between art and commerce, you know, Kanye on wanting to keep changing it, which, you know, the Jay probably liked a lot because then people would have to keep coming back to it and listening more on Tidal or like renewing their subscriptions or whatever. So, you know, again, one of the more recent collaborations with them and before things kind of fell off a cliff again.
Yeah, it was interesting hearing Jay recently on David Letterman, on Letterman's Netflix show, talking about Kanye, and just with no irony, no like wink, wink, nudge, nudge, was just like, Kanye's my little brother. Like, he's my little brother. Like, that's never gonna change. But then also saying like, you ever have a falling out with family? And Letterman was like, yeah, and you know, I'll let you know when it's over. And Jay kind of laughed. It was like, exactly.
Right.
And so it did seem like one of those things where it's, there's not that ill will, but there really is that like Cold War feeling of like, things aren't what they were, but I still love and care about you, but things aren't there.
Yeah. And, you know, just to go back to Big Brother, you know, and sort of the things Kanye said on that song were pretty remarkable for somebody who, you know, certainly has a great deal of pride, you know, to admit to how much he looked up to Jay-Z and, you know, call him his idol and his big brother and all this stuff. And, you know, I think Kanye is nothing if not honest. And I think that, you know, that still resonates today. But I think there's also that sort of little brother side of Kanye. And, you know, Kanye wants to be bigger than his big brother. And you know, it's hard when your big brother is Jay-Z.
that's not an easy shadow to walk in.
That's right.
Do you have a favorite personal Kanye story?
I do. I think my favorite was when it didn't really end well, but there's a fair amount of context that goes into it. So let's back up like 50 years. in 1968, my dad bought a used Porsche convertible, a 1964, for $2,000. So I'm guessing that would be like buying a, you know, well, I don't know, maybe paying like 20 grand for car now, used car. And for many decades, it was his only car. And then it kind of, he didn't use it for a while and it like fell into disrepair. And then he had it sort of like revived, probably in, I don't know, when I was in college or something, and got it up and running again. And for the first thing, I would do, you know, it was an old car, right? And it sort of was his baby. And he would let me drive it, but only with him in the car. And then finally, and it was just a few days after Yeezus came out, he let me take it with some buddies to go to the beach for the weekend. So, you know, Yeezus, get the Porsche out the damn garage, right?
Yeah.
Get the Porsche out the damn garage. We put down the top. We put in the – it doesn't have really a sound system. So we put in this, like, Beats Pill or something, and we're blasting Yeezus. And we're, you know, it's a beautiful day, just, like, gorgeous, 78 degrees. You know, maybe even a little hotter because you're driving down the highway and the sun is shining and the wind is perfect. And it's just, it's like, could not be better. And we're like exit 45 on the Long Island Expressway. And my buddy goes, you smell that? And I'm like, oh yeah, you know, it's like old car, whatever, you know, it's fine. And then I keep smelling it and I keep smelling it. And it's like, this is smokier than usual. And I kind of like look over my shoulder cause the engine is in the back cause it's a rear engine car. And there's like smoke just spewing out of the engine.
No.
I'm like, oh crap, we have to get it. So we pull over and we get to a gas station, and by now that's just like thick black smoke coming out of the engine. And so, and we like, at this point, we're pretty sure the car is on fire and possibly about to explode. So we park it in this, like in the middle of this parking lot by this gas station, away from everything. We grab all of our stuff. We like race out of the car. And we call AAA. Fortunately, the smoke subsides. We have to get flatbedded back, to Westchester County, where my dad lives. And by the time we get back there, it's like nighttime. You have to change cars, the whole thing. You know, after spending like an hour and a half crammed into a flatbed truck cab with this, you know, sweaty truck driver. And long story short, that was basically the end of the Porsche. So it was my dad had not used it very often, and so a fan belt had frayed and busted, and then the engine overheated and basically melted. And so he was able to – he got it back working, and he drove it a little bit more, but it just kept breaking down, and so he finally sold it. And, you know, I'd say he got his money back, but I don't know. Then again, when you – you never know how much you put into it over the years. But I will always associate Yeezus with that that really that last voyage of this sort of like family heirloom car that that I guess I won't be giving to my children.
If there's ever an appropriate album to go out to, I feel like Yeezus is the one.
I think so.
Oh man. Also, top five Kanye tracks.
Oh my God, jeez. I mean, you know, I got to put Stronger in there. All of the Lights I would have to put in there. What else? I mean, Homecoming. I would put the Sierra Leone remix. Diamonds from Sierra Leone, the one with Jay, with also that's partially because of Jay, and I'm not a businessman, I'm a businessman. What else? I mean, it's kind of like pick any other track from Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy. Right. I mean, like any really, I mean, just the whole thing is just so freaking genius. Yeah. I don't know. What about you? What are your top five?
My top five, they go Wolves, Real Friends, Blame Game, The Glory, and then it kind of shifts around, like Blood on the Leaves, Lost in the World.
Yeah,
it just kind of dances.
Yeah. There's just so much to choose from.
Well, I think we've arrived at the time for your last call. You just have an uninterrupted span of time to talk about whatever you want, and that's how we close out the show.
Last call. You know, so I would classify myself as sort of like somebody who has ended up defending Kanye in arguments with, you know, friends and colleagues and so on. But, you know, I got to say, he just kind of lost me at the Donald Trump lobby hugging thing. Like, what a weird way to end 2016. You know, if you had said that 2016 is going to end with President-elect Donald Trump hugging Kanye West in the lobby of Trump Tower, I mean, I could not have thought of a crazier thing than that. And I don't know. I think that Donald Trump is like part of that same kind of like dark American id that, you know, produced some of the reaction against Kanye, the backlash with the Taylor Swift thing. So it's just so inexplicable to me that he would end up in that, he would put himself in that kind of a situation. And, you know, though, I think that there is this sort of like, and I get into this in the afterword of Three Kings. If you go back and you look through the 90s, you will find a lot of mentions of Donald Trump in hip hop. And, you know, he was sort of this wealth mascot that a lot of people kind of held up to, you know, to want to be like, you know. And he was at the white party in the Hamptons with Diddy and Jay-Z, you know, and he was out there in New York at a lot of these same parties with a lot of these guys who were coming onto the scene. And, you know, so I think hip hop, as it moves forward and, you know, strives to be, I think in many cases, sort of more like Obama, to use another presidential example, you know, somebody like Kendrick Lamar or Jay-Z, you know, talking about mass incarceration, what have you, you know, hip hop kind of has to figure out, you know, what to do with this sort of like Trumpy past in some ways, you know, and sort of like the connections there, you know, the associations there, that look sort of a little weird, to say the least, in hindsight. So I think just as hip hop, you know, has to decide going forward, is it going to be more on the Obama side or the Trump side of things? You know, I think Kanye is going to probably have to reconcile, you know, multiple different sides of his own mind, and his own, you know, his own history. So I guess that's where I'd leave it.